Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are back with another fun-filled episode for all of you. We've got a return guest tonight, and I'll let Sam introduce him here in just a second. But, of course, that means I have to introduce Sam first. So, hey, Sam, what's up?
Well, things are relatively mild here in Colorado. We've had a lot of wind, but given what everybody else has dealt with, and for a change, it's not you, Jamie, we'll have to hear about everybody's strange day today. So usually when there's a weather event, we blame Kyle, and especially after he sends us a picture of him on the ski slopes.
Yeah, well, we've been nor'easter-free here on the East Coast for a whole week, and then we're kind of happy.
Yeah, and we're good here, but... you know, maybe I'll switch this around and talk to Dr. Joe first. What's going on down there in Memphis, Joe, right now?
Well, I just want to be clear. I blame Kyle for all this.
Of course.
Hanging on the ski slopes all day. Yeah, actually, we've got a pretty nasty storm getting very close right now. Lots of lightning and storms and tornadoes beginning to pop up around. So welcome to spring in the Memphis area, right?
For real. So we'll get to our guest, Dan, who actually had a tornado go through his town today. So we want to hear about that. But that's in Indiana, Kyle. So what do you have to say for yourself with this weather?
Well, Sam, welcome to springtime here in the U.S. With the changing of the seasons, folks, comes active weather patterns from coast to coast. Yes, Jamie, you've been nor'easter free. You and all the folks up there are super happy about that. But our attention now turns to the central part and southeast part of the country, as we do have several rounds of severe weather that have rolled through, including a widespread one tonight extending all the way from the Great Lakes down through the southern Mississippi River Valley. All kinds of severe weather reports from tornadoes to large hail and damaging winds, and sounds like several confirmed tornadoes tonight thus far. I know things were pretty interesting in Dan's neck of the woods, so I'll let him share that story, but looking ahead, an active week of weather again across the U.S. with continued warm temps in the western U.S. and cooler to the east. So that's it for me, Sam. Back to you.
Oh, you're smart. You're keeping it short. oh, gosh, what was that? I had something clever to say, and I totally forgot what it was. Oh, never mind. But, Jamie, before we move on to Dan, you and I were discussing another event that occurred in California today. I think we should talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, definitely. There earlier as the day we record this, which is actually April 3rd, we had reports of an active shooter incident at the YouTube headquarters in San Bruno, California. One individual dead of a self-inflicted gunshot wound and four individuals transported to the hospital with gunshot wounds. So, you know, we're not sure of all the details, but these things continue to happen. And by all evidence, police response was rapid. EMS response was rapid. And according to accepted principles of, you know, police heading directly in to the sound of the fire and trying to get to the situation as quickly as possible. So we'll find out more about it as things shake out. But it just, you know, as we continue to say, these disaster incidents, whether man-made or weather-related, whether they're tornadoes or active shooters, are likely to seem to be more likely to happen in your area. And it's important to be more prepared and to make sure your training is up to date and all of those other things. And keep listening here to the Disaster Podcast, because we'll try to keep you up to date on what's the best practices for all of these things as we continue to produce episodes here.
Absolutely. That couldn't be more true. I had another thought, too, and I lost it. I'm losing my mind tonight just a little bit. Well, nuts. I forgot what it was. Oh, one thing, though, I wanted to mention was when I got your text, I got the chills a little bit because I actually have a friend that works there at YouTube, but it had already gone through my team, and we are getting reports that that person was okay, so... that was a relief. It's when it's a little closer to home, it's a lot scarier. Just saying. So anyway, we're going to move on to Dan Zehner. He's been a guest here before, and we're eventually going to talk about some stuff he's got going on. But Dan, we have to hear about your weather adventure today. I mean, I've never had a guest say, can we bump this up a little bit because on account of this tornado that blew through town? It's like, all righty then. Okay, go for it, Dan.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be back and glad we didn't have to reschedule. We really? Had a little scare from this huge, long, but kind of thin band of storms that came through here today. And I was dropping off or picking up my wife's car from the mechanic on the south end of town. And I had a friend with me to help, you know, get the rental car situation and everything. And ended up looking at the sky. I was like, whoa, this is getting nasty. And he looked down at his phone and let it be known that the iPhone weather alerts went off and said the tornado warning at the appropriate time. The Google phone that I have did not.
Interesting. Good to know.
Yeah. So, you know, we heeded all the warnings and ended up holding up in the bathroom in the shop for I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes or something as it blew over. But there was a confirmed tornado on the ground about 14 miles away from us. And another possible, you know, small one that I don't know if it hit the ground or not, but it went right over downtown Lafayette. They had a center of rotation going right over downtown. So it was pretty hairy there for a bit, but it sounds like everybody came out okay.
Yeah, thankfully. Wow. I mean, this is obviously a big storm. Joe's getting it in Memphis, and Kyle was saying it's
It's huge. I mean, we were
yeah,
up like,
I mean, all the way up to you in Indiana.
Is just huge. We were, you know, up to mid 60s in temperature today, and it's going to get down to, you know, 29 tonight.
Oh yeah, that's the way our weather is. It's
my goodness.
70
looking forward
day
to
25.
Doing a Go Ruck challenge as part of my continuing training for you know, being prepared for everything on Friday night.
Yeah.
It's supposed to be starting off the evening at 43 and getting down to about 21 overnight and snowing while we're traipsing around downtown Indianapolis with 30 pounds of weight on our backs.
Gee, sounds like fun. So,
yeah.
So Kyle, I'm going to jump back to you for a minute, but what makes all of this so unstable, the air so unstable, and how long is this going to go on?
Well, Sam, the first part of your question, instability. So that's the tendency of air in the atmosphere to want to rise. And that occurs when we have warm air beneath cool air further up in the atmosphere, because warm air is less dense. It naturally wants to rise. And that's what we call an unstable situation. And instability is one of the ingredients that we need for severe weather and severe thunderstorms. So instability, that warm air near the surface wants to rise after it's been heated by the sun throughout the day. Then we need something to lift that air, such as the cold front coming through, which is like a wedge of cold air, forcing that warm air to rise and giving us that line of showers and thunderstorms. And we had ample moisture in place out of head of that cold front that's currently swinging through the central part of the U.S. there. And once you get into that situation, you have the perfect environment for thunderstorms.
Wow. So did Dan do the right thing in terms of taking shelter?
Absolutely. And it's all about heeding those warnings. And it's really curious that the Google phone did not alert. The alerts that are pushed to cell phones, those are the wireless emergency alerts, or WEAs, that you hear about. And that's not a subscription service, right? That's an opt-out type of service. So if that's a partnership between the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the cell phone carriers, so that if there's polygons like a tornado warning, for example, polygon drawn around a cell tower that you're pinging off of, your phone is, that alert will get pushed to you automatically, whether you signed up for it or not. So sounds like it was a good system and it worked, and that you guys did seek shelter. And that is the absolute best practice to do so. And it's great to hear that you followed through.
Yeah, we also were able to, you know, kind of help out the shop there too, and let them know, like, hey, you know, make sure to close those big overhead doors, because that's the path for the pressure to enter your building and knock the roof off. So let's get those closed, and, you know, kind of help them take the warnings a little bit more seriously too. So
Yeah, well, it's good when somebody like you knows what to do when other people are running around not knowing what to do. So
yeah.
They were lucky.
Like, well, you know, you guys can do this the way you want when I'm not here. But when I'm here and, you know, I don't feel like having a wrench go through my face or, you know, whatever parts would be flying around when you get wind in here, let's batten this sucker down. So
just a suggestion. Yeah. Well, good to know that about the phones, Kyle. And glad I got an iPhone at the moment. Anyway, let's move on to what we had planned to talk about.
It wasn't at the same time as the iPhone, so it was kind of interesting.
So, Dan, let's go back to maybe tell what you do. You want to give us an update on the NERI projects. So maybe you can do that and just we'll kind of go through those and see where we're at.
Yeah,
it's been a while since we talked about it. So
it's great to be back. So I'm working for a center funded by the National Science Foundation called NERI, or the Natural Hazards Engineering Research Infrastructure. Nice big mouthful. But it is a nationwide network of university test facilities all over the country. I work at Purdue University, and that's where the governance body is headquartered. So we kind of keep an eye on all of the test facilities. We work with a number of natural hazards, from tsunami and coastal erosion to earthquakes and geotechnical research to wind hazards from hurricanes and tornadoes and kind of everything in between, except for fire. For some reason, NSF doesn't want us to deal with fire. But we work with some of the largest, the most advanced testing apparatus in the world, geotechnical centrifuges, the world's largest outdoor shake table, wind tunnel facilities that could simulate Category 5 hurricanes indoors, things like that, to do large-scale, mostly structural testing, but also hybrid simulation. So testing of physical specimen in concert with large numerical models that feed back to each other in real time, so you can simulate large structures like parking garages and things like that. So that's what we're on about.
And that's why they should close those doors.
Yes, I know many wind engineers too.
Because that's what you do for a living. You figure this stuff out.
Yeah, I know enough about each of the hazard areas to be conversationally dangerous, at least.
Well, one thing you mentioned on your list was submarine volcano tsunami testing. That's kind of intriguing.
Yeah, this is a project that's upcoming at Oregon State University, who one of the many things that is awesome about them is they have live video of all their testing. So, you know, we'll give you guys a heads up once this gets started, but Herman Fritz is the principal engineer for this, or investigator for this, and he is putting a test rig into the directional wave basin at Oregon State University's Hinsdale Wave Research Lab. So to give you an idea of what this looks like, it's basically a just about Olympic-sized swimming pool, and at one end is 29 individually actuated paddles that can create any number of wave shapes you want. And what they're going to investigate is what happens when a volcano erupts and the tsunami waves that come off of that and how they impact structures on the shore. So they're going to create a volcano that's pneumatically actuated in the middle of this big wave tank, and some sort of coastline and bottom profile, or bathymetry as they call it, and maybe some structures on the shore, and do some measurements as they test probably a couple hundred times how this volcano eruption affects the waves out in the tank, and then as they approach the shore, what happens with the interaction in the shore.
So the purpose of that, of course, is to build the appropriate kind of shelter, or create it, or let people know about it.
Exactly. This is one of the, there's some, a few different kinds of testing that happen at each of these centers, and the National Science Foundation funds is more fundamental kind of research to understand the phenomena itself, as well as test structures to resist these natural phenomena. So some of these tests, like this volcanic eruption, is probably more just characterizing what that looks like, and not necessarily developing a particular structure to resist those tsunami. They've also got another test that's going on right now that they're trying to understand the fundamental mechanisms of rip currents and doing it in a really cool way where they're basically creating foam in the water tank and putting a bunch of packing peanuts in there so they can track it with a bunch of cameras and laser scanners or LIDAR. So basically radar, but with lasers instead of radio waves. And so they can map really accurately all the stuff floating in the waves so that they can understand what happens in a rip current environment. And also developing that measurement technique so that they can apply it to different experiments and then better understand how waves actually interact with the shoreline and structures and things.
Well, when you're talking about structures, is that something Dr. Joe can understand? Because being a USAR guy, they have to learn all about that, especially when they're trying to dig somebody out. Right, Joe?
Yes. Cool. Absolutely. And that's, you know, that's exactly what my, as I was listening to this, I was also wondering, first of all, this is fascinating to me, but are you guys also the ones that sort of set recommendations for building standards and, you know, for earthquake safe buildings and all that sort of stuff? Does that fall under you guys?
That is definitely a huge part of what we do is translating this research into code over the course of many years, as you know. But that's definitely one of the things that our centers do quite a bit of. Actually, another research project upcoming here from the University of Washington at Oregon State University is going to be looking at vertical evacuation structures that are going to be subjected to a sequential earthquake and then tsunami loading. So how you can put an evacuation structure into a building and build it around in such a way that it's both seismic resistant and then resistant to a tsunami hazard after it.
Wow. Thoughts, Jamie?
I just love hearing about this stuff. I mean, you know, for anybody that geeks out about building materials or disaster situations and you put the two together and you've got, you know, the perfect storm for what Dan does, especially with, you know, his podcast and the things he puts out on the updates from what they're doing over at these series of facilities around the country.
Yes, and he does post that info on our Facebook site, by the way, if you're interested in what he's doing. So what do you think, Kyle? This kind of directly relates to what you do.
No, absolutely. And, I mean, the advances that are being made on the research side support the entire, weather and just kind of the educational enterprise, because if it wasn't for research institutes like Dan works with, you know, we wouldn't have these new findings and these new technologies that come out that can help us build more disaster resilient and resistant buildings, to develop more effective rescue strategies and things, and then to be able to communicate that to the public on the education side. It all works together, and also to inform those that are on the operational side using that information to make real-time decisions to keep citizens safe. So think of that as a three-legged stool between kind of the application side, research, and the social side. And any three of those fail, the whole system falls apart. So it's absolutely critical that we support the research side of things as well and listen to what research is telling us.
Amen. Yeah, that's a really good point, Kyle.
We all agree.
One of the things that's been really impressing on me lately about some of the guests I've had on the podcast and the researchers I got to talk to is that, you know, you get this kind of mental image of like what a scientist or researcher looks like, right? They're holed up in the lab all the time and they don't get out in the real world much. But not so with the researchers that I work with. A lot of them do disaster reconnaissance missions in addition to their work in the laboratory, or they'll work with social scientists and other folks to understand the societal impacts and the economic impacts of the research that they're doing. So they really do kind of touch on all three of those legs of the stool like you were talking about, and not just focusing on the one.
So Dan, would it be safe to assume that you work with meteorologists in figuring this stuff out?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, some of our biggest allies are meteorologists, and handing off the data from you know, the meteorological community into some of the models that our research teams have built to predict. Storm surge forecasting is one of the big things that our supercomputing facility at the University of Texas does in coordination with, you know, various government laboratories and things like that. So they work really hand in hand, yeah.
Well, ironically, one of the things you mentioned on your list was tornado wind loading on low-rise buildings.
Low-rise. That research project is what they're looking at is residential structures. And they're doing some really interesting stuff using a 3D printed scale building in our wind tunnel facility at the university, or Florida International University, and instrumenting that building so that you can measure the internal pressure as you open various parts of it to the wind hazard, so they can see what happens to it. You know, what, say when your door blows in, or you open a window or garage door or whatever, then you can, they have pressure taps actually printed in place in the walls and the roof, so they can measure really a full profile of the internal pressure of that building as you change the structure during the hazard event.
That's really cool. I mean, I'm sure Kyle's geeking out about that too, because being able to measure those internal pressures from a storm that's passing through the building, as it were, right, Kyle?
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's really kind of the next frontier is, you know, can we maybe design with all these Internet of Things sensors and, you know, devices that we have, you know, can we engineer buildings to be smarter, to have these maybe auto closing or opening doors and things in place? And I think it also kind of underscores, too, that from some of the research that, Dan and his teams are doing, but also that's been done before. If you ever heard the old wives' tale of, oh, if a tornado is coming, go around and open all the windows so they equalize the pressure inside and outside of the building. Well, folks, I promise the tornado will do that for you. So so seek shelter like Dan did, and then go about seeking more information. So shelter first.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Your house does a great job of keeping the pressure out until, you know, your windows are breached by debris, and then you better hope that your roof is strapped on well to keep that in where it should be.
So I don't know, Sam, are you still there with us? Sometimes she hasn't.
Sam forgets to hit the mute button.
I wondered if that was what was going on. I was getting ready to say that.
So, Joe, going back to you, is this helpful to guys like you on USAR to learn something about these disaster-related engineering skills?
Oh, I think it works on many, many levels. You know, there's a great value in understanding how a structure responds to earthquake, tornado, you know, any of those events. Just if you understand how it fails, then you understand, you know, where to look for people and where people might have a chance of survival. But I think it also helps tremendously in understanding how you then access that building and understand, you know, almost in real time, what were the forces acting on this building? What things inside this building likely failed? How did they fail? And by understanding how they failed, then be able to use that knowledge to direct your rescue efforts toward, you know, most likely spots for survival, et cetera. So, you know, I could see actually the value in this almost in real time. After a storm passes through, kind of like the one that's outside my door right now. So I'm going to go open all my windows so I can equalize the pressure. Right there. You know, the availability of that kind of knowledge almost in real time is could be phenomenally valuable, much like it is with us in satellite imagery and mapping and the other things that we use very commonly. This is just another tool in the toolbox to better understand the dynamics of a very chaotic situation and place some order to it.
Stay away.
That's a really good point. We actually used some of the data that our various research teams were putting out, either from reconnaissance or by, you know, taking and overlaying weather data along with social media during the various hurricanes this past year to help pinpoint where likely damage was to occur and how much damage was occurring in various communities. And hopefully that did help some of the search and rescue operations that were going on.
Yeah, but I think it's a phenomenal triage tool at a very high level that allows you to at least move resources into the area and feel confident that you're placing very scarce resources in an area where they're most likely to be utilized and have value and are close to where they need to be. So, from a strategic standpoint, it's hugely impactful. And what I'll look forward to is as you guys continue to enhance the science, the more kind of tactical aspects of it related to a particular building or an individual situation that we're in.
And Dan, I have to tell you, though, one other thought. Having lived in the Bay Area, fortunately, I'm not there now because not that I'm crazy about tornadoes, but maybe they're better than earthquakes in some respect. But that area has a lot of bridges. And the one thing that scares the poop out of me is the idea of being on one of those bridges when there is a big one. You're doing some work on seismic hazards for bridges as well, aren't you?
Very much so, yeah. Actually, both of our seismic sites out in California, University of California at Davis and San Diego, do quite a bit of work with Caltrans, doing bridge abutments and pillar and deck and all sorts of different bridge piece work in between their NSF projects. So they're very much looking at that structure and how it can be made more resilient and how it interacts with the soil around it and different soil types and how those affect bridge structures and things like that.
And I remember, wasn't it the Northridge quake where a section of overpass came down on top of the section below it? And, you know,
That was Loma Prieta.
Oh, okay.
That was after. That was 89, I think.
Yeah. I just remember right very distinctly area. Seeing the imagery of this two sections of highway collapsed on top of each other and just seeing, seeing the rescue attempts of trying to get in there and see if anyone was in their cars trapped and stuff. Just significant. So I can imagine how, creating a better structural support that's more resilient in the face of a quake would be important in those situations, especially given traffic levels and the way cars are moving all the time on those major highways around Southern California.
Another thing we're doing in the seismic area around bridges is actually taking our fleet of mobile shaker trucks and taking them out to bridges and exciting them in a way with geophones along the bridge to measure the seismic response to a bridge and measure its kind of health, you could say, and then use that to see, feed it into a numerical model to see how the bridge would respond in an actual earthquake. So there's some really cool work going on in that space as well with, real structures and not just the parts of them in a laboratory setting as well.
Joe, you had a thought to throw up.
Well, I'm just really curious. I mean, this is fascinating. We're going out and shaking bridges, which is really cool. But the more I listen to this, the more I appreciate how incredibly broad the area of research is. I mean, it's everything. And so my question really is, where does the direction come from for the things that you guys are currently, looking at? How do you prioritize what you're looking at? How do you decide where to allocate resources and focus your attention? There's so many things to do.
Yeah, we've got a real team-based approach for that between the governance body of the network, the Network Coordination Office, the National Science Foundation, and each of the facilities themselves, as well as the researchers who are applying for funding. So we have a science plan that goes out the next 5 years about the kinds of areas that we would like to see research focused on that researchers can use as guidance when they're developing their proposals. The NSF also has guidance on their solicitations that come out twice a year about the areas that they would like to spend taxpayer money on. And then, of course, the individual institutions put on workshops a few times a year about, you know, kind of the state of the art of the different hazards, the areas that they do research in and where they'd like to see things go next. So it's a real team approach about kind of figuring out what the next horizon is in each of the different hazard areas that we look into.
Wow. Well, speaking of NSF, there you were saying there's a large facilities workshop coming up, eh?
Yeah. So the bigger organization that we're a part of spans not just natural hazards research, but also astronomy, radio telescopes, environmental observatories, all sorts of the large facilities that the NSF funds. And we've got a workshop every year coming up at the end of April, which is already April. This year, I'm really extremely happy to announce that NERI is taking a leadership role in this workshop. And we're going to be presenting, I think, in three different sessions. The keynote speaker actually is a friend of mine who we've been working with. He's a retired Navy SEAL officer and an engineer. His name is Larry Yatch, and he specializes in helping teams function better together, develop leaders, and also institute planning methods that he learned from his time in the SEALs and apply those to business and now science. And we've been applying that to great success in NERI and are looking forward to working with him further. So he's going to be our keynote speaker, and then we're going to be showing how his methods can apply to planning out scientific research projects in a couple of breakout sessions in the afternoon of the first day. NERI is going to be leading a panel discussion on how we capture and share lessons learned across our distributed network of facilities. So when one facility does something well, or maybe does something they don't want to do again, we share that and make sure that those lessons are shared to the other facilities so we can all improve as a network and grow closer as a team.
So we'll that makes sense.
Sharing about that and inviting the other facilities that are going to be attending there to share about some of their projects and how they've learned some best practices and lessons learned as well, and see what we can do to grow as an NSF community as well.
Awesome.
So, yeah, Jamie, it's going to be really exciting out in Washington, D.C. for 3 days.
Oh, wow. Jamie, you had a thought to share.
Well, I just wanted to point out that, you know, this isn't just, something that's like talked about and dealt with from an intellectual level. There's really, we talked about the practical applications as well. And also that you know, the information is there for everybody to check out. And I just, whenever we've had Dan on, this is the second time now, and I remember having a lot of fun during the discussion, scanning through the website and looking at all the stuff there. And as we were talking about the workshop that Dan, you were talking about, I was looking at the Learning Center on the Design Safe site.
Yeah.
That, you know, and I was impressed by the idea that you're not just talking about higher level, you know, doctoral research and major research, but you're also talking about bringing up the next group of researchers by reaching out to students in our schools and teaching them about how this research happens and inspiring the next generation.
Yeah, that's one of our big efforts is the educational and community outreach. I mean, there's a great article in the news section that I think you're referring to, is like showing, you know, grade school, middle school, high school science classes, you know, how to analyze real world responses to earthquakes. And we do a model wind tunnel that we take around to schools, all sorts of different curricula ideas that are available for science teachers to teach the next gen, teach and inspire the next generation of scientists. Part of our summer institute every year, now this will be the second year we've done it, is developing lesson plans for teachers to implement in their classes. Last year we had some awesome science teachers from a various different grade levels from the San Antonio area come in and talk to the world experts in all these hazard areas and help develop lesson plans to go that they could take back to their classrooms. It was really, really cool.
That is very cool.
My favorite, we got to actually experiment with how structures respond to vibrations, and we used a big floor amp and pumped some bass-heavy music through it to shake some structures apart.
Yeah, I'm sure the parents of some of those kids would be happy to learn that.
Oh, yeah.
The way they play their music. Well, finally, Dan, as we wind down, you have some other workshops coming up that I think Kyle might even be interested in. Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, there's a couple coming up in mid-May. There's actually they're on the same weekend, so you'll have to pick and choose. But one of them is at UC Davis about their geotechnical centrifuge modeling facility and how that can be used to investigate all sorts of seismic and geotechnical science problems. And then there is a joint workshop between Florida International University and our Rapid Response and Reconnaissance Center that's getting started this summer, also on the same weekend, May 17th and 18th. And that's down in Miami, Florida. And they'll be talking about hurricanes, hurricane research, and then also going over all the amazing equipment and capabilities at the Rapid, the drones, mobile LIDAR, all sorts of really cool equipment that's portable. And you can characterize a site after a disaster event with. The Rapid will also be having their own workshop coming up in late July. I believe it's the 24th through the 27th. I'll send you links for all this. But I think I'm going to go to that one, actually. Part of my next year of work at NERI, I'm going to be doing some more site visits out to the experimental sites again. And since the Rapid is just starting up, I haven't visited them yet. They have an intensive workshop for 4 days out in Seattle, going through a mock disaster scenario on the University of Washington campus and showing all these users, potential users of the equipment, how to characterize the site using drones and scanning equipment and LIDAR and all the things that they've got going on. It's going to be really, really cool.
And I have to say that one workshop, Kyle, there's something they call a wall of wind.
Yes.
I
just like the concept of something called a wall of wind.
Oh yeah. It's like saying my favorite kid, but it's one of my favorite experimental facilities at Florida International University. It's 12 mine exhaust fans stacked in two rows of six. And you have it's an open wind tunnel, so they can destroy things in it and not feel bad about it. And it can go up to 157 mile an hour winds, including rain. So you can do a Cat 5 hurricane and do all sorts of things with different raindrop sizes. And they have ways of customizing the roughness ahead of the wind field, so you can look at different turbulent flow characteristics. And they have a turntable that's 16 feet in diameter, and you can put up to, I believe, a 10-foot tall specimen on that, so you can see how the different sides of your specimen react to the wind and that kind of thing, and blow it apart.
Kyle, I know you're geeking out now.
Oh, yeah, I got my homework cut out for me now.
Oh, yeah. This facility started because of Hurricane Andrew, and they were very instrumental in updating the Florida Building Code after Hurricane Andrew. And they actually have a video on their YouTube page showing a pre-Andrew Building Code building and a post-Andrew Building Code building in their wind tunnel. It's pretty enlightening.
Wow, Jamie, you got to know that what Dan does, even though it's so unique, it really affects everything that Kyle and you and Joe and Jim and myself do in some respect.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, that as Joe was talking about earlier, and that one, I think the one workshop coming up where they're going to be modeling the campus and showing how to model a disaster response by creating that campus in miniature, I guess, and then modeling different forces affecting it. Joe, that comes right back to the types of things where you eventually have to prepare to bring the people factor into that type of training.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the idea that we could have access to information like that and truly model the event in maximum realism just gives me goosebumps. I definitely want it.
Yeah, I will say we're actually doing it full scale on our campus. We're just pretending it's been decimated by a tsunami or something. So some of the students are going to be confused with our drones flying over or something.
Very cool.
This is one of the times where we're not using models. We're just going to be using the real thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
So Joe, when you think about these types of things and the type of training you guys do at Paragon Medical Education Group with everything that you do, it really gives you an opportunity when you're working with, say, for instance, a USAR team, helping them prepare for their next event, understanding how these building codes and these materials studies really work into how you guys are going to approach a structure.
Well, it absolutely does. I mean, it's all so integrated with each of these areas of science are tied to each other in multiple different ways. And it not only allows us to sort of predict where we're likely to find survivors, but helps us to predict the kind of injuries we might expect to see and, a whole range of issues that are impacting a person who might have been injured or affected by that disaster.
So if folks want to find out, how you can bring your unique types of training and the experiential instructors that you have to come in and talk about what they've actually worked on and how to apply their knowledge to the people taking the class so that they can be better prepared for what happens in their community. Where can people find you, reach out to you, and most importantly, talk with you about making that customized program for their jurisdiction?
Well, that's exactly what we want, is to actually talk to folks. We pride ourselves on being able to develop a very unique experience for each of our customers and to fit exactly what they need. And we would just ask those folks to reach out to us at on the web at paragonmedicaleducationgroup.com. You can find us on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group as well. And you can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast. And by the way, I am going to go try to buy one of those shake trucks because I want one of those for my next simulation.
We have a shake truck around here, but it's got ice cream in it. So
yeah, I got one of those too. It's not nearly the same thing.
Jello.
Well, thanks, Joe. Dan, where can folks find you on especially your podcast and where they can get even more updates about what you all are doing? Where's the best place where they can find what you're doing?
Yeah, thanks. The podcast is called Design Safe Radio. Design Safe is all one word. And the website is designsafe-ci.org. If you want to know more about the facilities, there's a site for each one of them underneath there. There's a learning center and news. We're also on Facebook and Twitter everywhere as Natural Hazards Engineering Research Infrastructure on Facebook, and then at NARI Design Safe, I believe, on Twitter and Facebook as well. So that's us everywhere.
Excellent. And we'll have links to all that in the show notes so that people can find you. And as Sam alluded to earlier, you're active in our Facebook page, or Facebook group, I should say. And we appreciate that when you post updates and things you think might be of interest to our community. We appreciate you getting in there and dropping those links. So thank you.
Oh, yeah.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. And I'm easy to get a hold of, too. So if anybody's got any questions about any of these hazard areas or getting a hold of a scientist for anything, and they love to talk to the public about what they're doing, so feel free to ask any question you got about any of these hazard areas. Be happy to point you in the right direction.
Excellent.
He does shake a lot when you touch him.
That's really
Hey Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. Feel free to connect and reach out to me on any social media platforms and talk research applications and everywhere in between. Always happy to continue the conversation.
And Sam, how about you?
Pretty much the same thing in social media land under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11. And of course, on the Facebook page for Disaster Podcast and on the disasterpodcast.com website. How about you, Jimmy?
Well, I'm under the handle Podmedic in most places. So friend, follow me or otherwise reach out to me on most social media platforms that way. Catch up with us in our Facebook group. Just search for Disaster Podcast and ask to join the group. We'll be happy to bring you in, and you can join the conversation in there. Look for some of the things that Dan has been posting periodically over the course of the last couple of months. And, of course, all our episodes get posted in there as well, where you can leave comments and questions. I know we had a recent episode on opioids and crush syndrome, and Joe was engaging with some comments and questions in there to make sure people had the best possible information, and that's what we're all about. So keep it up. You know, Sam, I'm thinking, you know, this is we're going to have Dan back. I know Dan will be happy to come back, but we definitely want to keep in touch with what's going on with these folks and the different research centers as they gain more information and kind of are able to put out some of the data and conclusions they come up with as they find out what works and what doesn't work with designing safe structures and materials for us to withstand disaster.
Absolutely. And we always have fun with Dan. He's just kind of a fun guy to talk to. So,
well, thanks. You guys are a pretty fun bunch yourselves.
Yeah, it's always tonight started out a little weird. Sorry about your tornado. Hopefully they're gone. But, you know, this is just another great example. I mean, we talk about the tornadoes and the active events and then what we do about them after the fact, but we don't talk about the people that are actually trying to find the best way to help prevent injuries and deaths. So good on you for doing that, Dan, and hopefully we'll talk to you soon. But so this is, Jamie, this is kind of a unique example of disaster medicine and disaster not being our everyday medicine.